Hi, welcome to another edition of NPR on Science. I'm Joe Palca, a member of the Science Desk at NPR. On this edition of On Science, we're going to explore the use of music to tell a science story. Now, you can't just use music to get people's attention, or to entertain them, or to keep them listening so they'll stick with you as you tell your story. But you can also use music to help explain something. In radio, we don't have the luxury of pretty graphs and pictures. But we do try, of course, to paint pictures in your head or get you to paint your own pictures. But anyway, it's possible to use an audio analogy to get a point across, and I'll play a couple examples of that. But first, let's have a little fun with music. My colleague Robert Krulwich has made quite a career of creating amusing musical moments. Here, he presents a critical observation about hair.
Call it, if you like, the baldness gap. There's no obvious explanation for this, but we're going to start with the Russians.
Okay, well, one of the odd things about baldness is there's a strange pattern in the history of Russia. Now, what this means, I have absolutely no idea.
But when you look at portraits of Russia's leaders since 1917, just look at their photos, which is what Stephen Jones, head of the biology department at the University College in London, did one day, you see this startling pattern.
You have an amazing regularity. Lenin was bald, Stalin was hairy, Khrushchev was bald, Brezhnev was hairy, Andropov was bald, Chernenko was hairy, Gorbachev was bald, Yeltsin was hairy, Putin was bald, and Medvedev, believe it or not, is hairy. Now, what that means, I honestly do not know.
But the pattern is so on and off, so even and so rhythmic, you could almost dance to it.
Lenin was bald.
But Stalin was hairy.
Khrushchev was bald.
But Brezhnev was hairy.
Andropov bald.
Chernenko hairy.
Gorbachev bald.
Yeltsin hairy.
Putin is bald.
Medvedev is hairy.
They switch back and forth. The pattern is scary. Bald.
Stalin hairy.
Khrushchev bald.
Brezhnev hairy.
Gorbachev bald.
Yeltsin hairy.
Putin bald. Medvedev hairy.
Hey! Okay. So having firmly established now that half Russia's leaders have been bald...
It does... open the question as to, I mean, why have there been no bald American presidents? Certainly, since Eisenhower, there haven't been.
Well, there was Jerry Ford. He was bald-ish, but Ford was not elected, I know. And of course, there are a lot of baldies out there.
It's really quite common.
Right, but we don't choose them because...
Many people say because that's because bald men are less attractive.
Yeah, but in a year when so many pioneers have broken through, women, men over 70, blacks, Mormons, Jews, the only semi-bald man seeking higher office, Senator Joe Biden, he decided a few years ago to get himself unbalded, so there is still a baldness barrier.
Which is really quite strange.
And embarrassing to discover that instead of a missile gap like we used to have with Russia, in 2008 we have a baldness gap. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Lenin was bald.
But Stalin was hairy.
Khrushchev was bald.
But Brezhnev was hairy.
And while we're on the subject of Russian names set to music, I can't resist playing the finest example of that. Not even slightly scientific, but definitely worth hearing.
Desmalachevsky, Rubinstein, Arensky, and Tchaikovsky, Sapelnikov, Dmitriev, Cherepnin, Krizhinovsky, Kodovsky, Altobuchov, Moni, Yusko, Akimenko, Soloviev, Prokofiev, Tyemkin, Goroshenko, Des, Glinkla, Winkla, Bortnyansky, Rebekov, Velinsky, Desmetr, Balakirov, Zolotorov, and Kvoschinsky, and Sokolov, and Kopolov, Dukelsky, and Kanovsky, and Shostakovich, Borodinglier, and Novakovsky, Des Lyudov, and Karganov, Markeyevich, Panchenko, and Dargomisky, Chervachev, Skrabin, Vasilenko, Stravinsky, Rimsky, Korsakov, Musors, Nyangra, Chaninov, and Glazunov, and Sezak, Vikalinik, Rachmanov, Stravinsky, Yangra, Rachmaninoff, Rumchinsky and Rachmaninoff. I really ought to stop. The subject has been dwelt upon enough.
Stravinsky!
Rachmaninoff!
Rumchinsky!
Rachmaninoff!
We really feel we ought to stop because you've underdone enough.
I love that. That was Danny Kaye singing the patter song Tchaikovsky from the musical Lady in the Dark. That was 54 Russian composer names in about 38 seconds. Now, so far we've been talking about music as fun, but as I said, it can be used in a more scientifically illustrative way. Take the story I did about the emergence of the human ability to use tools. Geneticist James Noonan of Yale University is trying to understand what makes humans human. Why we can speak and other animals can't. Why we can walk upright on two legs. Why we can snap our fingers. To do that, he combs through the billions of letters of DNA that make up the human genome.
We're proceeding from the idea that there are sequences in the genome that distinguish humans from other species, and we really don't know what those are or where they are.
To find these hidden sequences, Noonan has an interesting strategy. He doesn't just look at the DNA in humans. He looks through the DNA in a variety of species: mice, chickens, dogs, chimpanzees.
We asked, are there any where it's clear that the sequence has been evolutionarily stable for a long period of evolutionary time, but now in humans is different?
You can think of it this way. Let's say there's a sequence of DNA in, say, a mouse that sounds like this. Then you look at the same region of DNA in a chicken and a dog, even a chimpanzee, it sounds the same. But if you look at the sequence in humans, it's changed, mutated. It's still the same tune, but more complex. Geneticist Noonan searched for these DNA sequences that were different in humans than other animals, and found one. As he reports in the journal Science, at first he had no idea what this sequence did. It didn't look like a traditional gene. It looked like what's called a regulatory element, something that controls when and where genes switch on and off. So he took his human DNA sequence and injected it into a mouse egg to see which cells it became active in as the mouse embryo developed. To his delight, it affected cells near the developing limbs, specifically to the place where a mouse thumb would be if a mouse had a real thumb. Noonan says this sequence, unique to humans, appears to control a critical aspect of hand development.
That's why we're so excited about this result, because we think maybe this sequence is one of those components that changed our evolution and is driving those sorts of developmental changes in the hand that differentiate us from other species.
That's an extremely reasonable hypothesis, at least according to Brian Richmond. Richmond is an anthropologist at George Washington University.
Most changes in human evolution don't involve brand new structures that come out of nowhere. Rather, almost all of the ways that humans are different from other animals and other primates is mainly due to changes in the rate, timing, and duration of growth.
Richmond says the bones, tendons, and muscles that make up a hand in humans and chimpanzees are basically the same. It's how fast they grow and when they start and stop growing that makes all the difference.
That seems to be how we grow fingers that are shorter and grow a thumb that is long compared to apes.
So it makes sense that the new DNA sequence Noonan found would control when genes were turning on and off in the developing limb. Greg Ray of Duke University says Noonan's technique for finding hidden but important pieces of DNA should reveal a lot about evolution.
The fact that we don't always know exactly what those pieces do doesn't mean they can't tell us something about our history, and that's what's really interesting.
Because everybody likes to know what makes humans special. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. Anyway, I checked with Noonan about that sound analogy, actually, before I used it, and he told me he thought it was a very good one. In fact, he said in a subsequent email, he said he was planning to use it in his teaching efforts. So I think it did help get the idea across of how DNA can remain stable for long periods of time and then change. Now, this idea of using musical analogies is hardly new with me, and I went back into the NPR archives to find an example of it from my colleague Richard Harris. He did a story back in 1991 about a new technique for identifying the genes from the junk, the stuff we used to call junk anyway, in our DNA, and how some scientists were up in arms about the notion of patenting genes. And you'll hear Richard's version of a musical analogy near the start of this piece.
In order to understand this controversy, you need to know a thing or two about the genes that determine who you are. These 100,000 genetic instructions are scattered along 46 giant coils of DNA, your chromosomes. And if you could unravel a chromosome and play the information on that DNA like a tape recording, it might sound something like this.
have your toe bone connected to your foot bone. From your foot bone connected to your heel bone.
Most of the DNA appears to be nonsense, but every now and then there's that snippet of information. Human cells have their own internal editors that pick out the parts that make sense and assemble those pieces. Craig Venter at the NIH decided to use nature's own editing system on a grand scale.
So we're using billions of years of evolution to remove all the nonsense and leave us with the important information.
Now, Venter's technique leaves a lot of interesting questions about those genes unanswered. He doesn't know where the information is stored on the chromosome, and most of the snippets aren't even complete genes, just fragments. But these fragments are still potentially quite useful as a research tool, and he can generate them at a breathtaking pace compared to the conventional genetic techniques.
We found that we can find out new information on the human 1,000 to 10,000 times faster and cheaper.
Venter has already isolated well over 2,000 genes or gene fragments. He figures that 5% of them are linked to some sort of human disease.
It means we have potentially the genes for 150 human diseases right now in the laboratory.
If that's true, he's sitting on a bonanza of genetic information that could be used to develop new diagnostic tools or drugs. And because of that, the National Institutes of Health has decided to try to patent all the gene fragments they isolate. But the very idea galls some prominent scientists and people in the biotech industry. James Watson, the scientist who discovered the structure of DNA and now heads the Human Genome Project, calls the patent request sheer lunacy. Maynard Olson, a Howard Hughes scholar at Washington University in St. Louis, says the NIH should never have applied for a patent on this material.
I think a lot of scientists feel ideologically myself, that the sequence of the human genome should be, if anything, should be in the public domain.
Olson says if Venter's gene fragments do get patented, and the fragments turn out to be part of some important and profitable drug, the worry is that the NIH could claim rights to that drug, even though scientists there didn't do all the hard work to develop it.
It's kind of like going out and just staking gold claims hither and yon in the hopes that someday someone will find gold on them and you'll own the rights.
And if the patent office decides to allow that kind of claim, that could spark a patent gold rush in biotechnology. Scientists worry they'd be driven to patent their discoveries every step of the way. But people who know the ways of the patent office say those fears appear to be exaggerated. William Duffy, Monsanto's chief patent officer, says the patent office simply isn't likely to grant sweeping rights to the first person who identifies a gene fragment.
I really believe that the patent laws will self-limit any mischief or any overzealous activities.
Duffy says patents can be used to help or hinder development of new products, depending upon who holds them. So he's relieved to see that the NIH is seeking those patents, because that means the information would be available, though scientists might have to pay a fee to use it. It may seem wrong that anybody could claim ownership of basic information like this, but Washington patent attorney Jeffrey Carney says new genetic discoveries need to be patented at some point, otherwise the biotech industry would grind to a halt.
No company is going to expend the time, money, and resources to bring, for example, a new drug to market without patent protection.
What the patent office has to decide now is whether information about gene fragments from the NIH deserves patent protection at all. Patent officials aren't likely to rule on that issue until next year. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Actually, those patent officials never did rule on that question because the following year, NIH essentially withdrew the patent applications because the new director of the NIH decided that this wasn't the way he wanted the agency to proceed with gene patenting. There's another interesting thing for the human genome fans among you. Yes, that Craig Venter at NIH is the same Craig Venter who left the government and eventually launched his own project to sequence the human genome in competition with the government. And finally, those regions of DNA that Richard represented as junk in the musical analogy near the top of his piece, in between the important bits of DNA that make up genes, well, it's a piece of that junk that I was talking about when I was explaining in my piece how the human hand evolved. I guess that's a reminder that today's junk might be tomorrow's treasure. That's all for this edition of On Science. I'm Joe Palca.